Welcome to MCC from the Capitol, a podcast produced by the Missouri Catholic Conference. We invite you to listen along as our host and executive director, Tyler McClay, chats with experts about public policy issues from a Catholic perspective. We hope you enjoy this episode of MCC from the Capitol.
Welcome to the Missouri Catholic Conference from the Capitol podcast, where we take a deeper look at the social and political issues facing Missouri and the Catholic Church and how those issues impact public policy. Today we're going to be discussing one of the modern threats to life, that being population control. We all know the Church's longstanding commitment to life from conception to natural death. But what does the Church have to say about the modern push to control population as a means of reducing the threat to our lifestyles and well-being as a species? In his encyclical, The Gospel of Life, written in 1995, Pope John Paul II identifies various ways in which the modern world has attacked life, including through wars and the widespread use of contraception, sterilization, abortion, and even euthanasia. But he also points to another phenomenon used to justify attacks on life, what he calls the demographic question. He remarks that the developed countries are seeing a decline and even a collapse of their birth rates, and international aid to poorer countries with larger birth rates tends to focus on anti-birth policies rather than on policies that would promote a more just production and distribution of resources. John Paul goes on to state that we are, in fact, faced by an objective conspiracy against life, involving even international institutions engaged in and carrying out actual campaigns to make contraception, sterilization, and abortion widely available. So today we're going to focus our discussion on the idea of the demographic question that has been spoken about so much over the last few decades. Are we facing the threat of overpopulation, for example? I'm joined today by Jamie Morris, MCC staffer, who's going to introduce our guest today, Jonathan Last. So, Jamie, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Tyler. We're so excited today to be joined by Jonathan V. Last, executive editor of the news and political website, The Bulwark. Prior to his work at The Bulwark, Jonathan was a writer and editor at The Weekly Standard, and his writings have been featured in numerous publications, including The Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, and The Washington Post. Jonathan also researches and writes about demographic trends and the falling American birth rate. In 2013, his first book was released, What to Expect When No One's Expecting, America's Coming Demographic Disaster, which we'll be discussing today. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
No problem. And I guess before we get started, you've done a lot of work over your career discussing this demographic issue and question. And how did you get interested in this topic?
I read a book by a fellow named Philip Longman called The Empty Cradle, and it is the best book ever written about demographics. And it was one of those demographics is a weird subject. It's a little bit like numerology. Like once you dip your toe into it a little bit, you just get sucked down the rabbit hole, and because it starts to explain everything. You know, like if you are interested in real estate prices, demographics will speak to that. If you're interested in foreign affairs, demographics will speak to that. And I read this book by Philip Longman and I loved it. And I then fell into this stuff really because of Phil's kindness. I called him. He works at a liberal think tank in Washington, and I said, this is like, you know, me heavy breathing on the phone. I was like, hi, you're so great. I really love you. Could we have lunch or something? And, you know, instead of reporting me to the police, he said yes. And
those that work in demographics probably are not used to having groupies, I would imagine.
I think maybe that's right. Yeah.
Is that a fair statement?
I think that's probably true. And so we went out and he was so unbelievably generous just intellectually. And he said, you know, boy, if you're really interested in this stuff, you should read this, 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 and this, and then do this, 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 and that. And so I just started reading and then going further and further down the rabbit hole. And as I learned more, I realized that there were some things I had to say too, because the subject is always changing. And I spent about 7 years then writing the book that came out in 2013. And it's all because Phil was so generous in helping me get started on the subject. And so I think I said that in the foreword of the book, everybody should have at least two demographic books on their bookshelves. You should pay for two of these things. But if you're only going to buy one, buy Phil's and not mine.
Yeah. We'll tell Erwin to buy yours. We'll put the plug in for you. But on that same token, we do appreciate you spending your time with us as well and sharing your knowledge. And I think Tyler and I both really found the book fascinating. And I guess to sort of set the table with this, you know, could you just kind of give us the quick 30-second discussion as to where we stand as a planet in terms of not dealing with the birth rate, but in terms of just total population, and how has that changed, say, over the last 500 years?
Yeah, so over the last 500 years, the total population has increased hugely dramatically. You know, it took something like 100 million years to get the first million people alive, and then everything started snowballing since then. I mean, when you and I were kids, there were 4 billion people on the planet, and now just 40 years later, we're at like 7.5 billion. So what has happened is a bunch of different things. When we're talking global population historically, the most important driver of the increase is not birth control, but death control. So it's just, you know, people used to live to like 19 years old on average, and now people live to like 70 years old on average. So you just get more people alive at the same time. And it looks like we are headed to a peak global population of something like 11 or 12 billion. That'll probably happen, we think, by the end of this century. And then global population is probably going to start contracting. Now, again, that is all if trends that we have been seeing for the last 50 or 60 years basically follow along the same trajectories, and they may not. So I always tell people when you're talking about demographics, you should be really, really suspicious of anybody who talks about this stuff as if they are reporting from the future. You know, like if they just got out of a DeLorean and their hair is crazy and they'll tell you, this is what it's going to look like in 2050, because nobody knows what it's going to look like in 2050. We can only make educated guesses.
Well, and then I think that leads then to the birth rate. And so as a absolute number, the population is increasing. And I think all of us have heard this sort of population bomb or the fear of overpopulation. So could you discuss that a little bit as to, you know, do we need to be worried about the population increasing at the rate it has been?
No, we don't. So these fears about population, they go back a long, long time. I mean, the most famous of these people is Thomas Malthus, who was writing about the dangers of overpopulation in the early 19th century. And we most famously have had it in Western countries dating back to the 40s, 50s, and then the late 1960s, when it became really a popular concept due to a book called The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich, which is basically the most wrong book that's ever been written. It's insane how wrong he turned out to be. You know, when he wrote this book, which sold millions and millions of copies, he said that within a matter of 1 or 2 years, hundreds of millions of people were going to die of starvation and overpopulation. And we were headed towards this post-apocalyptic Mad Max style world. And it would be like that within just a handful of years. And this all happened at the he wrote this at precisely the moment that the opposite was happening, that we had the Green Revolution in agriculture, people were not starving to death, populations were increasing, but also all the measures that you would think of as quality of life were increasing as well. People were living longer, they were being better educated, they were making more money. We were really in the verge of a nice technological revolution that raised most people around the globe's standard of living and brought them out of poverty.
How does something like that get such a foothold? I mean, to be so wrong on something that is objectively, you know, we had the numbers, we know what the birth rate looks like. Was it just it played into everyone's fears at the time, or?
Yeah, it makes a superficial kind of sense, right? For anybody who doesn't know much about math, right, which is a lot of people, it makes a superficial kind of sense, because you say, okay, well, in 1950, America had 120 million people, and today it's 70 years later, and America has 330 million people. So that means that in another 70 years, we will have, you know, you sort of plop on another, you know, double it and then double it again. And because they're not looking at the rates of increase, and people are very bad. This is just a normal thing. People can understand numerical increases. They're very bad at the idea of geometric increases. Like, this is why people missed, just like, you know, starting in January, the significance of COVID, right? The people, they just can't understand doubling rates because our minds aren't wired to work that way. And so what's really interesting, so Ehrlich, it's important to understand, Paul Ehrlich was not a demographer. He was an entomologist. He studied butterflies. And so all of his theories about this stuff came from watching the population in butterfly colonies collapse when food stores became exhausted. And so he was convinced that human beings behave exactly the way butterflies do. And so as Ehrlich was writing this, all of the professional demographers, like the people at the United Nations and the people at, various, Stanford and Harvard and the various academic disciplines, they were all looking at the exact opposite problem, which was they saw collapsing birth rates throughout the West and they couldn't figure out why this was happening. And they were beginning to get worried about depopulation. So there's this weird moment where the academics and the people who do this stuff for a living are all thinking about the opposite problem. But then in the popular culture, if you just, look at the New York Times bestseller list or you listen to politicians, those people are worried about the other thing, which is not real. So it was deeply frustrating. But I think we've basically come around on this. I would say at this point, the only people left who really, really think hard about overpopulation tend to be the most radical environmentalists and the most virulent racists. And so the two places where they wind up holding hands is you have the white nationalist types who are endlessly concerned about all of the brown people in Africa and South America having kids, saying that the world is heading towards overpopulation. We've got to stop this. And then you have the radical environmentalists who see human beings as basically a virus, who say, well, the planet has a fixed carrying capacity. And if we go past 8 billion people, then there will be cataclysms. And so we have to stop having babies. But that's about it. Everywhere else, if you look at the governments in Europe, the governments in Asia, even the Chinese have abandoned their one-child policy because they see that it has set up enormous problems for them. And they're trying desperately to reverse their birth rate and try to get people to have more babies. Even at the governmental level, I think people have basically internalized the real truth of what's going on, which is that birth rates are too low. We're headed towards real economic problems because of this and societal problems possibly.
Sure. Well, then let's talk then about total fertility rate. We kind of talked in the absolute numbers, but could you kind of give us a quick background as to when we talk total fertility rate, what that means? And you've already hit on it a little bit, but kind of where the American and even the world trajectory is on this.
Yeah. So the total fertility rate is the number of babies that the average woman has in her lifetime. And in order for population to be constant in any given subset, you need the total fertility rate to be 2.1. That makes sense, right? Everybody can understand that. Every woman needs to have two kids plus a little bit because some women will die before they reach childbearing age. That's where the 0.1 comes from. And within a fixed population, meaning no immigration, no emigration, if the fertility rate is above 2.1, then population will be increasing. And if it's below 2.1, then population will eventually begin decreasing after the last above 2.1 generation dies off. So think about it this way. If you have a country where in 1950, the fertility rate is 2.5, but then by 1940, it goes down to 1.8. After that generation from 1950 finally dies out 70 years later, your population contracts, even though it's been increasing all along. Does that make sense to you?
There's going to be a little bit
I would
of
draw
a
you a diagram if we were correct. So there's a lag on this as you wait again for the last above replacement generation to die out. And so this is why, again, as a superficial matter, you look at it and the populations look like they're increasing. But the problem is that the rate of increase keeps diminishing until that last above replacement population dies off, and then they begin decreasing and the decrease rate accelerates. So this is, again, people are bad at seeing DXDT. So where we are in America, we have been below the replacement rate in America since about 1970. We are right now lower than we have ever been in American history, just below 1.7. The global average has been heading dramatically downward and is still above replacement, but the trends on this are negative. Basically, all but, I think it's like, 4% of the world's countries, I think, have fertility rates that are not heading downwards. And when you look at this, this spans everywhere. It's Muslim countries, it's developed countries, it's African countries, it's northern countries. And so there's just something going on here. And the answer is that there are a lot of somethings going on, and some of those drivers are universal. They're impacting everybody. And some of them are very specific. And some of those drivers are good things. They're not bad things. Like the decline in infant mortality rates is probably the single biggest driver in the collapse of fertility rates. And that's good, right? I mean, we are happy that you don't have to have 10 babies in order to get 3 kids who turn 18. That's a good thing. But they're not all good.
Yeah, well, could you kind of expand on that a little bit, especially in regards to America? What are some of those that tend to be the prevailing factors then for this decrease in birth rate?
Yeah, so, you know, when you look at what's happening in America, there are a giant constellation of drivers. And again, I want to talk about these without any value judgments on them. The biggest one is the decline in infant mortality, which is great. Another one is the increase in educational attainment. And this, people tend to misunderstand this. I got a bunch of people writing about my book who were like, you just think women should be barefoot and pregnant and not go to college. And that's not true. I don't actually think that, but even if I did think that, that's not what's going on with educational attainment. The reason women who have greater levels of educational attainment tend to have fewer babies is simply temporal. Like there's a time series here, which is that if you only graduate from high school, then by 18, you're starting your life. If you graduate from medical school, then you're not really starting your professional life until you're about 26. You may not even be getting married then until you're 28 or 29, which is like the average age of first marriage now in America. And that then means your entire child rearing window is basically like 11 years. It's hard to fit in the same number of kids as somebody who is starting their professional life at like 19 or 20. And then on top of that, you have the cost of it. So, you know, once people start educating themselves more, they carry around bigger debt loads, which causes them to put off having kids and getting married. And it makes the costs prospectively of having children even larger. In his book, Phil Longman does the math on this and shows that for the first kid in America, the real cost for an average first kid in terms of both the fixed costs of, like, you know, buying car seats and diapers and all that, but then added in with the education costs of college, the childcare costs, and then the foregone wage costs of, you know, a parent taking care of the kid, winds up being close to like $1.1 million for a kid.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That is an enormous amount of money, right? And so this is, again, another one of our drivers, right? So if we're putting things into buckets here, we have the declines of infant mortality, we have the increasing educational attainments, and then everything that carries with it in terms of delaying first marriage, stuff like that. We have divorce, right? So when you start introducing widespread divorce, and now something like 40% of all marriages end in divorce, a divorce is going to interrupt essentially your childbearing years, right? So not a whole lot of women are going to get married, then get divorced. And then even if they get remarried at some point, you know, be looking to have kids in that interregnum period. So you're just taking time out of that fixed window of biology here. And another one is just the basic economics of the capitalist system. When you look at the capitalist system, our economic system does not place any monetary value on children at all. And instead, it allows capital holders and employers to harvest the economic benefits of people raising children without giving anything back, right? Amazon wants to have a gigantic workforce of highly educated people who all know how to code, right? But Amazon is not doing anything to make it easier for their workers to have and educate children, right? And in fact, quite the opposite. And almost anybody who has kids will tell you having kids is a huge professional burden, right? Especially the higher you go on the wage scale. And so what are you supposed to do? And even if you're not talking about people high on the wage scale, you're just talking about an average worker. If I were going to tell you just from a purely economic point, how do you get ahead in America economically? The answer would be don't have kids, right? All the money that you would be spending on kids, put away and save. And that's $1 million. That's like 4 times the median home price in America. This means over the course of 22 years, you could buy 4 pieces of real estate, which you could then be renting out, right? And what do you do if you have a kid, then 15 years later, she's going to stamp up the stairs and slam the door and scream, I hate you. You're like, great.
Now, as far as sort of our experience here in America, though, we've also, our fertility rate has been recently propped up a little bit by immigration, though, too, has it not?
Yes. So, and this is the only reason that we've even hung around where we have. And we were for 15 years or so, we were right just under 2 or right at 2.0 was because we had a huge influx in Hispanic immigrants. So we've got roughly 40 million immigrants in America right now, the vast majority of them from Mexico and Central and South America. And those folks came here with higher fertility rates than native-born Americans. But what has happened is, and again, this goes back to like the white nationalist stuff. So there was a lot of hand-wringing over the last 30 or 40 years from, you know, the super white nationalist set in America over, we're being overrun by these Mexican hordes who are having 15 million babies and blah, 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 blah. And this just turned out to be simply wrong. The reason we've seen the big drop over the last 5 or 6 years or so that we've seen in our fertility rate is because the Hispanic fertility rates are rushing back to the mean way faster than most people outside of professional demographic circles expected. The professional demographers were reasonably right about this. They thought that Hispanic fertility was not likely to remain elevated over generations, and it has proved to be correct.
So they come to America and then very quickly assimilate into the patterns that we see here. Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, the truth is, our fertility makeup would be a lot healthier if Hispanic fertility levels stayed elevated. They just haven't done that, and when you look at it, I'm not really surprised, frankly, because again, all of the factors that affect all native-born Americans are coming to bear on recent immigrants as well, right? I mean, they are seeing the same economic pressures, they are seeing the same patterns in marriage and divorce and education, and they're seeing the same patterns in increasing secularization, which we can talk about too. That's another one of the big drivers or correlators in all of this.
What role does religion play in regards to the birth rate?
So this is one of those things where we should always be careful whether we're talking correlation and causation.
Sure.
And the question of religion is a place where you could plausibly make both arguments. You could say, well, so what we're seeing here is correlation or it's causation. Religion is the single best indicator of fertility attainments in the United States. So, which is to say that one of my parlor tricks, as I have become like Mr. Demographics, is when I'll give a speech, when we get to the question and answer period, I'll tell people, if you want, I'll ask you 3 questions about yourself, and then I'll guess how many kids you have. And the first question I always ask is, how often do you attend religious services? Because that answer, more than anything else, more than your race, more than your income, more than where you live, more than what your educational attainment is, that correlates most strongly with how many kids you wind up having over the course of your life. And this is really interesting because the question is not what religion are you? It isn't, are you Catholic or Protestant or Jew or Muslim?
Just across the board religious practice.
It is what is your practice? And this is not how it always was. So if you go back to the 1950s, we had very, very clear fertility patterns where Catholics were highest and then Protestants. And we didn't really have evangelicals back then, and then Jews below them. And then beginning in the 80s and 90s, those lines all converged. And the differentiation came in religiosity, which is the demographic term for how often you show up at services. And that's where you see the big differentiator. So if you go to services basically once a week, doesn't matter whether you're Mormon or Jewish or whatever, you're going to have like 2.6 kids. If you go to services once a month, you're going to be around 2.4. If you are Christmas and Easter type, or whatever the version of that is for your particular sect, that puts you down around 1.9. And if you don't go, if you just don't show up, you're like 1.5, I think it is. And so it's just a huge gap then. And this to me is a really evocative, the most evocative of all the correlations here, because it suggests a deep, deep tie between religion and having kids, and a tie that can't be explained by religious tenets. You know, I would say this is something non-believers do. When non-believers hear this, they say, oh, well, that's because everybody takes that be fruitful and multiply stuff seriously. And I don't think that's what it is. I don't think it is that religious believers see it as a positive command from their magisterium to have kids. I think it is much more to do with what your outlook on the purpose of life is.
We were joking earlier about the cost of raising a kid and how difficult it is, but there almost has to be something else for you to make a decision to bring, you know, children into this world for all the reasons we've talked about, for the cost, for the challenge of it. There almost has to be some other deep reason, would there not?
Yeah, I absolutely. You know, I always joke that anybody who's stupid can have a kid once, right? Because you think to yourself, well, everybody else is doing it. I mean, maybe it's fun. And then you have the kid and you realize, no, this isn't fun at all. To have a second kid, you have to view yourself as an actor who has obligations to something bigger than yourself. And if you are secular, maybe that something bigger than yourself is liberal democracy or the environment or supporting National Public Radio or whatever. But those are probably pretty weak attachments, all things told. What religious believers have is a view of themselves as not being the center of the world, right? And they are, I always try to talk about this without getting too wishy-washy. People who believe in God, and this is sort of true across all beliefs systems, they view themselves as having a positive duty both to the people who came before them and the people who will come after them. And I think that that is the single clearest rationale for having kids is, you know, it isn't fun. It isn't profitable. It isn't lots of things. But what it is a fulfillment of your duty to those who brought us here and to those who come after us. And an acknowledgement that your life here is a fleeting moment and that you stand in a long line of people who believe in something bigger. And I think that that is probably what is going on and what's happening with the religiosity numbers, at least in America.
And I believe you this was your term in the book, but at some point with this sort of correlation, do we get, I think your words were, the devout will inherit the earth. And so, is there a chance long term that if this holds, obviously, if those that are more serious in their, or, you know, in their religious practice continue to be above replacement rate, do we have a period where things shake out over the long term where then the total fertility rate would then bump back up? I don't know if I explained that very well.
Yeah, but no, I see what you're saying. So this is important when I write about like the problems with the collapsing fertility rate and depopulation and shrinking populations, the worry is never that we are heading to some children of man type dystopian future where there are like five people left. That's not how it works. Because as you say, there are always subpopulations which are above replacement rate. And then over the course of several generations, those people wind up inheriting the earth. So the problem is not that like this big blue ball of mud is going to tick down to zero people left. Like that's not on offer. But when you talk about the religious inheriting the earth, that is so far in the future. I mean, that is many, many generations in the future. And what comes between now and then is so unstable and dangerous. That's what worries me. You know, so the reason I think all of this stuff is a problem, and a lot of other people do too, is that we have a series of systems in modern life which depend on, we're all very interconnected, right? And so just to take the simplest thing in the world, how is Medicare and Social Security supposed to work when there are more people over the age of 70 than under the age of 20, right? Like that, you just can't make it work. And so think about that problem, but magnified to 100 and then taking place basically in every single country on the planet over the course of one 50-year period. And that winds up pointing towards real instability. And when you have instability, you have danger.
And can we tell right now, like if things, and again, knowing that things can change, what sort of trajectory we're on to where do we hit that tipping point, do you think?
Well, so in America, where we hit the tipping point, we're close to it. Our last above replacement generation is the people who were born in 1970, I think. So those folks are 50 years old. We're almost there, another 20 years or so. Now that will be masked by the influx of immigrants who, again, just as a pure numbers game, right? You are adding bodies to the population now. Countries which don't have large immigration, like Italy and Japan and South Korea, they're already seeing it. There are plenty of countries in the world right now where they are going backwards already in terms of total population numbers. You know, they have fewer people this year than they did the year before. And so that in America, we will depend, that question will be answered entirely by what we do with regards to immigration policy. But even there, you have a supply side problem, which is that historically, and this doesn't mean it'll happen like this today, but historically, when countries are sub-replacement rate, they don't send out many emigrants. And we are highly dependent upon Mexico, Central, and South America for sources of immigration. All of those places are either below replacement level now or are ticking close to replacement, down close to replacement level. And so we may not actually have a supply of people coming in, regardless of what we decide we want to do in terms of immigration policy.
Well, and we work in public policy, so I guess the natural question is, what are the policies? Are there policies? What can be done to reverse this trend?
Well, people have been trying to reverse these sorts of trends going back to the time of the Roman Empire. They literally had a bachelor tax in order to try to get people to have more kids. Stalin tried to get people to have more kids. The Chinese right now are trying to get people to have more kids. The Scandinavian countries have spent like 50 years trying to get people to have more kids. When you look at all the different policies people have tried, in general, things don't work very well. You can stop people from having kids. So you can be antinatalist as a policy matter. You know, China is able to stop people from having kids. But being pronatalist in a way that's effective is really, really hard.
I guess we're talking about economic incentives, or is that sort of what we're talking about? Tax credits, or what sort of policies are we talking about?
It runs the gamut, right? I mean, there are social initiatives, there are economic incentives. You know, Singapore is the perfect example of this. So when you look at Singapore, had an antinatalist regime where they thought they had too many kids and their fertility rate was too high, And within just a few years of trying to discourage births, they saw that it was working so well that they had to throw everything in reverse. And so they did the type of pronatalist policy work that somebody like me would just moon over. They were setting up government-sponsored 401ks, essentially, for childcare expenses, where for every dollar you put into it, the government would match dollar for dollar to help pay for school and diapers and kids' food and doctor's visits and stuff like that. They were paying baby bonuses, like really serious money, $10,000 or $20,000 for you having an extra kid. Because Singapore is a command economy, they would, if you had a third kid, they would help your in-laws, so the kids' grandparents, move closer to you so that you had like intergenerational childcare. I mean, all sorts of crazy, awesome
literally
stuff.
Paying people to have children.
Yeah. And their fertility rate is now like 1.1. I think it's close to the lowest in all of recorded history. And you see the same thing in France. You see the same thing in Sweden. You see the same thing in Estonia and Canada. There are lots and lots of different ways that governments try to entice people to have more kids. And some of them show some effectiveness in certain instances. Some of them show very little effectiveness. Some of them show no effectiveness whatsoever. In the big survey data on this suggests that you get an incredibly small return on your investment. Now, my view does not mean that you shouldn't try. You know, I don't say that, you know, oh, so we can't be done, we shouldn't bother trying it. I just think that it's worth experimenting at small scales in lots of different ways to see if you can find things that work. And I think that we in general should, as a policy matter, try to hit bank shots and not go after the direct problem, right? So, you know, one of the things I would be very concerned about is solving the college expense problem, right? If you can get college so that your average tuition at a four-year college is not, $36,000 a year or whatever it is right now, that would be a way to attack fertility rates. Because in general, you know, what I say in the book is this, sociologists track this thing called aspirational fertility, where you ask people, well, you know, how many in a perfect world with no real constraints, how many kids would you like to have? And in America, that number is still higher than actual fertility. I think it's like 2.6 or 2.4. People still want more kids than they're having. And so the answer here is not to try to convince people to have more kids. It's to try to find ways to create bridges that get people from their achieved fertility to their aspirational fertility. And I think that is probably the right lens to look at this entire thing through if you're approaching it as a matter of policy.
Meaning you're not going to be necessarily talking someone that doesn't want children into having children, but for that person that says, boy, I'd really like to have two or three kids, what can we set in place to make that possible, I guess, or make it easier for those people? Is that what
you're
saying?
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, you know, one of the things a lot of countries do is they do baby bonuses. So they will go and just literally throw money. You have a second kid, here's a check for $20,000. I don't think that's especially effective. The literature says it's not very effective, and it makes sense.
Well, I'm the oldest of six. My parents would have loved that.
Sure, no, you would have loved it, and certainly I would have loved to have had the check as well. But also, if I was on the fence about having a kid, there is no way in the world that $20,000 would work to bring me over, because $20,000 is a drop in the bucket, right? The costs are all much bigger and more structural, and they are around things like affording the house that you're in, right? Affording childcare, affording Catholic schools, if you want your kid going to Catholic schools, affording colleges. So again, this is why I think the most promising policy pathways really look at the problems that parents have now and tries to smooth that grade over for them. If that makes sense, and to then see if the fertility rate responds to that.
Jonathan, that's so great. I appreciate your time with us today. The one thing I wanted to say as we kind of close is that when we talk about the demographic question and we talk about fertility and the way that we've been doing, it almost sounds like you know, we see children as a burden as opposed to being a blessing and a joy. And obviously each of us are fathers, so we've experienced both the blessing and the curse, if you will, of having kids. But we all take joy in our families, and the church certainly would talk about children in that sense as well, right? We don't want to get too dark on talking about our kids in a positive and negative way.
You don't have to answer that, Jonathan, if you don't want
confessional.
To.
This sounds like every confession I've had for the last 12 years. look, in all honesty, I don't think it's wrong to view children as half blessing, half cross, right? Because the cross is in itself a blessing, right?
Right.
From a Catholic point of view, right, because the cross is a blessing, that is certainly how you should view children. But when I talk about this stuff, I really try to think about it because the majority of America is not Catholic. And if you view the world in a fully secular way, well, is it really a blessing? Maybe. I mean, look, you know, some kids are easier than others. Some kids are more fun than others, et cetera, et cetera. But if you view the world in the secular sense of like, hey, my job is to be here and to do good and to have fun and really suck the marrow out of life, kids are not actually going to be a ton of fun that way. They are not a good path to self-actualization. And, you know, the Catholic worldview on this, of course, is that self-actualization is not the point.
Right, right. It's not about you, right?
Yeah, no, that's exactly
right.
Life
is not about us. Yeah, that's really interesting. Which I think plays into your whole idea that people that are of faith, whether they're Catholic or not, see themselves in the world, not necessarily about the world not being just about them. It's about a greater good, right?
Yeah. So. And I don't want to be all doom and gloom. There is some incredibly fun stuff about having kids, especially as they get older. But, you know, like it isn't all puppies and ice cream and unicorns, you know.
Like, right.
And there's a lot of stuff that's really hard and that is a pure cross. And that's okay, though, right? I mean, this is part of the Catholic life is learning to embrace the cross, not because it's fun, but because, you know, this is what you're called to do. And so they're always beautiful in that way, right? Is, you know, there's a secular writer whose name I'm forgetting, right? Jennifer Senior, who wrote a great book about parenthood. And the title is perfect: All Joy and No Fun. And I think that is a really part. It's actually, it was one of those titles that's so good that you almost didn't need to read the book.
Right.
And it's such a perfect description of parenthood, I think. And if you are the type of person who views life as a series of fun events strung together, then parenthood is probably not going to be very rewarding to you because the payoffs of it are much deeper and more complicated.
Well, that is a great way to end, I think, on that note, even though it's a little bit of a challenge for us to think about. But for sure, anyone that's a parent knows exactly what you're talking about, and that title is perfect. And I'm so grateful for you to take the time, Jonathan, and share your knowledge and wisdom with us. It's certainly very interesting. I mean, the fact that it took you 7 years to write the book tells you everything you need to know about the book. It's really well written and incredibly insightful, has great information. And just to be clear, I mean, none of us are saying every Catholic needs to have 12 kids. I mean, I think our conversation here is an attempt to try to show where we are demographically as a country, and also just maybe how can we encourage folks to reach their aspirational family, the number that they really want to have.
Yeah, that's. Can I give one piece of advice before?
Yeah.
I know you're trying to close out the show, but the one marriage. Marriage is so deeply connected in all of this, and to a significant part when we talk about the demographic problem, like we also really talk about a marriage problem. And one of the things that I when I go and talk on college campuses about this stuff, and I will almost always get somebody who is indignant and saying, you know, you're telling me that I should just have, you know, 7 kids right now. And I'm always like, hold your horses.
No,
there.
No, no.
I am not going to shoulder the blame for you having any kids. That's on you, you know? But what I do tell people is that, especially when you're younger, we don't take the idea of marriage seriously enough. And what I mean is this, when I'm on like college campuses talking to kids, it will often happen that I'll say, you know, so what do you think about marriage? And they're like, think about marriage. I will start thinking about marriage when I'm 25. You know, they view it as just something to happen older. And I say to them, look, you should marry the person that you are meant to marry, right? You know, there's I'm very Princess Bride-y about this. You know, there is one person on earth who is your soulmate, and you know, you should get married when you find them. But you should view the idea of finding that person at least as seriously as you viewed getting into college. You know, and most people in America like start obsessing about college by like eighth grade. They're like, gosh, well, I got to start putting together my portfolio and doing my charity work. And I'm really, do I want to be in an SEC school or an Ivy League? Or do I really want to go to Northwestern? They put a tremendous amount of thought and importance into the decision of where they go to university. And what I say is just, I would like you to think about marriage as seriously as you thought about that. You know, and you don't have to start when you're in eighth grade. But you should think about it as, hey, this is a thing that someday I will do, and it's going to be incredibly impactful on my overall happiness and the shape of my life. And so I'm going to think about it and think about it seriously and approach it as seriously as I would trying to get high SAT scores. This doesn't mean you have to get married when you're 18 or anything like that. You get married when you're 35 if you don't meet the right person until you're 35. But take it seriously, because I promise you that marrying the right person will be way more determinative of your future than going to college X versus university Y.
Amen to that.
Such good advice, and I can wholeheartedly agree. Happy wife, happy life, right, as they say?
Totally true. 100% true.
Absolutely true. Well, Jonathan, thanks again for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation. I sure have, and have wanted to have this conversation for some time. So I'm really glad we got a chance to do this. Thank you so much for being with us today.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of MCC from the Capitol. To hear more from the Missouri Catholic Conference, visit our website at mocatholic.org. That's mocatholic.org. Or subscribe to this podcast on Spotify.